All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Dale Thronberry.
And good afternoon, America, and welcome to Veterans Radio. And I want to say to all my veteran brothers and sisters, thank you for your service and for all that you've done. And thank you for coming home safely, and I want to welcome you all home. Today we're going to be talking about Vietnam. We're going to be talking about helicopter pilots. We're going to be talking about pulling pitch, clear, right, left, over, and above, all kinds of different terminology, and it's going to be fun. We're going to have Bob Ford, who's the author of Black Cat 2-1, a story of his adventures in Vietnam. Was a Huey pilot there, and so that I'm excited to talk to Bob when I bring him on the air in just a little bit. But there's a couple of things that I wanted to remind everybody of. You know, we've got Facebook, and we also are on Twitter, and we're also podcasting many of our programs. So I encourage you to go to the VeteransRadio.net website, and you'll have access to all of those things. This week, I've got two things I wanted to mention this week. Thank you for the people that sent me these articles. Number one was an article that came from the New York Post, and this is talking about the Army dogs, you know, these war dogs is what they are. And the idea is that originally that when the men and women were coming back, these dog handlers from Iraq and Afghanistan, they were supposed to have first option in order to get their dogs. Well, the government, in their infinite wisdom, again, as usual, and the Army in some of its infinite wisdom, had hired a private contractor to take care of the dogs once they get home, and they were supposed to notify the veterans that their dogs were available for adoption and they could, you know, they had right of first refusal. Well, this is not happening. And so all of these dogs, or a great number of these dogs, are being adopted by people that are not attached to the military, not attached to the dog, and some of them are getting dogs that, you know, they're not really trained to be around children, and they're not trained to be around families many of the times. And many of these dog handlers are coming back with their traumatic brain injuries and their post-traumatic stress and so forth, and they're not getting their dogs. And so next week on Veterans Radio, we are going to be talking about this problem as one issue that we're going to be talking about with the author of the article that we found in the New York Post that was sent to me. And I encourage you all to go to the NewYorkPost.com website and check out this article. In fact, I'll put it up on Facebook later on if I haven't done so already. But it just put in war dogs, and this will come up, and you'll be able to read it and get as outraged as I am and as many of the people around here. You know, we've got two or three dog handlers that live in our local area, and I'm sure that when they read this, they're going to be hopping on in their car or on their motorcycles and going straight to Washington. This is unacceptable. Segue to almost as unacceptable as the female pilots of World War II are being denied the ability to be buried in Arlington Cemetery. Now, let me talk about this just real quick, because we're going to talk about this next week also. But I don't know how many of you are familiar that we did a program on this, and they were called WASPs. And these were the Women Air Force Service Pilots. And what they did during World War II is they acted as trainers, instructor pilots. They ferried airplanes from the East Coast to the West Coast, from the West Coast to the East Coast. And for 4 years, this is what they did. And 38 of them died as a result of this. And in 1944, as the war was coming to a close, the Army just decided, well, we don't need you anymore. See you later. Bye. No benefits, you know, no internment in military cemeteries, nothing. Just thanks for your service. Go back and be a housewife. Well, during the Carter era, 1977, I believe it was, the Army finally recognized that these women were considered veterans and that they were entitled to some benefits, and especially to the idea of being buried in a military cemetery. Fast forward to this last year, and the Army has come up with a technicality that doesn't allow these pilots, and you'll notice I say pilots, to be buried at Arlington. The excuse they gave is that Arlington's getting too full. It's going to be full up by 2030. Although there are 30,000, I'm not sure what they're called, the spaces available for urns to be kept. So there's no excuse. And this was found out because of this woman. Her name was Elaine Danford Harmon. She's 95 when she died. and her family sought to have her ashes placed in Arlington, and they were turned away. And this is just not right. And so we want to hear from you. So go to our Facebook page, send me an email, Dale@VeteransRadio.com. I want to know how you feel about this issue. Is it important or is it not important? Is it something to get our dander up? Is it something that we all need to do, you and me and everybody else out there, to contact our congresspeople and let them know we're not happy with this? All these guys that are out there running for president say, oh, the veterans this, oh, we're going to give the veterans everything in the world. Well, all I get is a lot of lip service from all these people. I don't see anybody coming up with a good plan of how you're going to take care of veterans and how are you going to take care of older veterans. These women were part of that greatest generation as well. And so we strongly encourage you to, again, this article is in the New York Times. I know many of you don't read the New York Times, but it's not a bad article, really. It talks about the female pilots we betrayed. So go to NewYorkTimes.com, put in WASP in that one, in your search engine, and you'll find it. And I want you to get involved. I want you to get involved in both of these things, these female pilots from World War II and also the dogs that are not being given back to their dog handlers. Both of these things are unacceptable. So I'm going to take a quick breather here and do some meditating to calm myself down. And then we're going to come back with our guest for the day, who is Bob Ford, better known as Black Cat 21. And we're going to play a little intro to our interview. So be patient. It runs about 2 minutes, but I think you'll all really appreciate it. But first, we're going to take a little commercial break here, and then we'll be right back. You're listening to Veterans Radio.
Anybody here today who doesn't thrill to the sound of those blades? That familiar wop 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 is the soundtrack of our war, the lullaby of our younger days. To someone who spent his time in Nam with the grunts, I've got to tell you that noise was always a great comfort. It meant someone was coming to help. Someone was coming to get our wounded. Someone was coming to bring us water and ammo. Someone was coming to take our dead brothers home. And eventually, someone was coming to give us a ride out of hell. Even today, when I hear it, I stop, catch my breath, and think back to those days. I love you guys as only an infantryman can. No matter how bad things were, if we called, you came. Down through the green tracers and other visible signs of a real bad day, off to a real bad start. To us, you seemed beyond brave and fearless, that you would come to us in the middle of battle, in those flimsy, thin-skinned crates, and in the storm of fire, you would sit up there behind that thin plexiglass, seeming so patient and so calm and so vulnerable, waiting for the offloading and the onloading. We thought you were God's own lunatics, and we loved you, still do. We're the fortunate ones. We survived when so many better men gave up their precious lives for us. We owe them a sacred debt to live each day to its fullest. What they're saying when you listen hard enough is this: we're at peace, and so should you be. And so should you be.
That was Joe Galloway from the documentary In the Shadow of the Blade, one of my obviously favorite documentaries about helicopters, which is a story of bringing a rebuilt Huey from the West Coast to the East Coast. Actually, it's at Smithsonian, at the National Air Museum right now. Anyhow, I played that to let you know. My buttons are bursting. I'm so proud of what we were able to accomplish while we were in Vietnam. And I want to welcome our guest today, and he is Bob Ford, who is the author of a relatively new book, Black Cat 21. That's his call sign. The true story of a Vietnam helicopter pilot and his crew. And Bob, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Dale, thank you so much. It's an honor, quite an honor. I recognized Joe Galloway's voice, three words out of his mouth. I knew who that was.
I know. Well, he's kind of a spokesman for the Vietnam veteran, and we're very grateful and happy to have him. He's been on our program a number of times. And for our audience who's not familiar with who Joe Galloway is he was a war correspondent during the Vietnam War, and he was there at the very beginning in the battle for the I Drang Valley, which was made well-known, I guess you could say, and We Were Soldiers Once and Young. And so I encourage people to check out In the Shadow of the Blade. I think it's a great documentary anyway.
It is.
But I wanted to introduce Bob, who was in Vietnam from July 1967 to July 1968, flew over 1,000 missions in Vietnam. After his first 6 weeks, he became an aircraft commander. That's really quick. And took over the command of a helicopter detachment in Hue, 40 miles from the DMZ, the farthest northern helicopter unit in Vietnam. His tour included the beginning of the siege for Khe Sanh and the Tet Offensive in February 1968, when he and his men manned the perimeter for a three-day, three-night ground attack. Quite the adventure, I would say, wouldn't you, Bob?
It was. It sure was. And I'm as proud of making an AC aircraft commander in 6 weeks as I am of anything.
Well, I
was very proud of that.
Oh, I would think so. It took me a little over 3.5 months to do that. But there also has to be a slot available. I was trying to explain to somebody, you know, we need to have slot. And the difference between you as an officer and me as a warrant officer, which was kind of a civilian in the Army, was that you had command responsibility and all these other things. And so you had to, you know, if there was somebody missing, as in your case, you had to go step forward and replace them.
Well, that's true. But as far as command goes, I had seven other warrants in my detachment that were just outstanding. And one of them, the oldest one, he was a real old guy. He was 26. And yeah, and he acted like the sergeant also for me, and he'd been around, been enlisted man for 5 years, and Tom Pullen acted like a sergeant for me, and absolutely everything ran very smooth. But one thing I did have to do was almost every night was report to the MACV commander, a full colonel named Peter Kelly, and that was part of the detachment command, and report in on the landline at night to company headquarters, which I always had a junior pilot do that. I knew if I talked to them, then they would want to ask questions.
That's true.
And then I'd have to answer them. And so I let the junior guy call in, and they wouldn't answer him anything because he'd say, you know, I don't know. And he wouldn't.
No, nobody ever told us anything. It was
That's right.
They just said, okay, get in the helicopter and follow the guy in front. Mm-hmm. Okay, we're on our way.
Well, Dale, you're correct though about a slot opening. You're absolutely correct, and I found out later that the other aircraft commanders were under a little pressure to accelerate my learning curve so I would be able to make it, not given, but certainly earn aircraft commander orders. And they pushed me quite hard and let me fly the left seat after a month, and pushed me really quite hard in order to get it. Then my company commander, Major Chuck Ward, had all the faith in me that any young lieutenant could have, and he just said, "Don't disappoint me." That's the only instructions he gave me.
No,
and
sir.
There I went.
Off we go. Off we go. Well,
that's right.
Well, Bob, let's go back before you went into the service, and let's get started at the beginning, as they say. You grew up in Oklahoma, correct?
I did.
What made
best
you
childhood a guy could ever have? On my own, you know how that goes back in those days.
Absolutely.
You're on your own day and night. Just make sure you come home for dinner and don't be too late.
Right.
And that was it.
That's right. Yeah. In my case, if the street light, you didn't have street lights probably, but if the street lights came on, we had to be home.
You knew it. That's true. But I was always fishing or hunting or something like that. And my mom usually knew where I was, and she would give a long and two shorts going through the out perimeter of the neighborhood. And that meant come home. And so I'd hustle home.
So what made you decide to join the Army?
I always wanted to serve. The World War II movies always instilled a sense of serving. And when I went through the ROTC program, the advanced ROTC, I knew I'd be serving some way, somehow. And before I went to the summer camp at Fort Sill between the junior and senior year of college at OU, that I asked the infantry captain of Texas A&M, really liked the guy, really Strack all the way.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, sir, if I looks like things are going pretty hard in Vietnam, so I'm pretty sure I'm going to be going. Matter of fact, I'm going to volunteer. What would be the best way to serve my country? And he never hesitated. He said, be a helicopter pilot. And by the way, he may have been on that I-Drang. I didn't know about it at the time, but he may have been on that I-Drang operation because he's the first cav guy. And anyway, that's what I thought, my gosh, he meant, and that's what I did. I committed myself and had another year of obligation, and off I went.
And off you went to Fort Walters, Texas, correct?
Fort Walters, yes.
In beautiful downtown Mineral Wells.
Yeah, Miserable Wells. We jokingly, all of us called, and I know all of y'all did too, we called it Miserable Wells.
Mm-hmm.
And jokingly, but honest to gosh, you never could find nicer people than Texas in general and Mineral Wells in particular.
Well, they were certainly
wonderful.
Yeah, they were certainly welcoming to us when we got out there. And it seemed to me it was in the middle of just nowhere. And, you know, the recreational facilities like Possum Kingdom Lake really made me nervous.
That's true. There's two reasons why the Camp Walters was changed to Fort Walters in the helicopter training. Number one, all the stage fields and all the landing zones that we had available to us were given to the Army only on the simple fact that when they quit using it, the Army quit using it, it reverted back to the farmer.
Mm-hmm.
It was all for free, and also there was a lot of apparently general flight time weather-wise. I heard that Fort Walters was as good a place as any, and we could fly almost year-round.
That was pretty close. I can remember. Mm-hmm. I arrived there in January of 1968, and you know we only had a couple of days where we had cold weather and one ice storm, and I think that was about it the whole time we were there.
Mm-hmm. That's it.
But anyway, so tell me about, you know, we're talking now with Bob Ford, who's the author of a book entitled Black Cat 2-1, and you always have to say 2-1 because 20 got people all confused and they couldn't figure out what a 20 or a 21 was.
That's
so everybody
right.
was a dash because I was Sky Chief 2-0, and
yep.
it's just the way that it was.
That's right.
And so off to Fort Walters you go, and you learned how to fly what type of helicopter?
The OH-23 made by Hiller, and I soloed in that, and then I had an experience that only I've never heard it happen again. I had a very unique experience. After 2 months, they picked 3 lieutenants to fly and infuse into a warrant officer candidate class. So that meant not only you had to go with a different group of guys, but also you had to start flying a complete different aircraft from the OH-23 over to the TH-55. And as you know, everything was different about it. As a student pilot, it seemed very different. It even looked a lot different. And the main characteristic of auto rotation was extremely different. And it was an experiment to see if a student pilot could infuse into another aircraft and catch up with the syllabus and graduate with the class. And one of the lieutenants never soloed on the darn thing. The other one had an extreme amount of difficulty and soloing and never really caught up, but I enjoyed the heck out of it. But the main thrust of the whole thing, the main experience that I had was getting to know the warrant officer candidates. I thought, my gosh, I just didn't know those kids like this were out there. I really didn't. They're so much different than the commissioned officers, and I knew after 2 weeks that if I fly in combat, these are the guys I want to fly with.
Well,
no question about it.
Very kind. It was an unusual group of people. The thing I found about most of the warrant officers is that they, much like you, they wanted to be pilots.
Yes.
And many of them had been pilots, you know, or at least learned how to fly Piper Cubs and all those other things. And again, all of our concentration was just on flying. We didn't have to mess around too much with the command and all those other things. We got a 4-week introduction into how to be an officer, and that didn't work.
That was it.
You know, we had to eat a square meal and, you know, learn all of the different, GE the conventions and so on and so forth. But that was about it. And after that, we just had to go fly, which was which to me, it sounds like with you too, is just the most exciting thing ever imaginable.
It was. It sure was. And that's another thing that motivated me to become aircraft commander. By taking over that detachment, I was away from all the protocol and company headquarters in Da Nang. And that really interested me a lot. And I just fell into eight or seven of the best guys you could ever want to be around.
Well, I could certainly understand that. It was exciting. So you were flying in the hill of the OH-23, which is
yes.
kind of it's a leftover from Korea almost.
It was.
The same. That's what I had to fly also.
Yeah. And I love that thing. Dale, this is how people ask me, what was it like? I said, well, when you went out there, when you started that thing up, it sounded like two well-muffled motorcycles.
That's
I loved how that thing went bop, bop, bop like that. Remember how it started up? It was the neatest sound. You knew you were doing something cool. And then to put me in there and let me go fly that thing for free. Oh, man.
I
loved every minute of it.
Somebody asked me a question the other day, and I'm sorry, folks, but this is what happens when two pilots get together to talk about what they were doing. In your book, Black Cat 2-1, you also talk about the idea of actually soloing, which was so exciting.
It was.
You know,
yes.
when the instructor says, gets out and says,
yeah.
Okay, take it around. Who?
Yeah. I know it. It was. It was. I wasn't prepared for it at all. I mean, I kind of thought I was doing well, sure. But then when he hopped out, I thought, holy moly. And the first thing I did, and I bet you did the same thing, you started to pick it up, and that thing just shot in the air because you didn't have that extra weight on the left side.
Right. It popped up. It popped up.
Yeah.
And then he told me to take around. And then in addition to that, he says, take it back to the main heliport.
Oh, you did?
I said, by myself?
Well, that is good. No, I didn't do that.
Oh, I did that. That was the most frightening thing. You know, well, anyways, it's like a traffic jam, folks.
Yeah.
A couple of hundred helicopters trying to land on one field, and many of them have students in it, and it was just crazy.
You must have been exceptional.
Yeah. Either that. I'm not sure, but I do remember my instructor pilot for Southern?
Yeah. Southern Airways.
Southern Airways. Yeah. Yeah, he gave us, my best friend and I, when we soloed and we were done, he gave us a bottle of Wild Turkey.
Oh, that was nice.
That was very nice. He was a good guy. And
my instructor just pointed his finger at me and said, hey, you're the first one in the class to solo. And he pointed his finger 2 inches from my nose and said, now, don't get cocky.
Don't go killing yourself or anything like that.
Yeah, that's what he told me.
Right. All right, so we learned how to fly. Which was very exciting and a big adventure and so forth. And from Fort Walters, we go down to Fort Rucker, Alabama.
Mm-hmm.
One of those other beautiful parts of the world that the Army has a tendency to put their bases. And there you did instrument flying?
Tough stuff. Yes, it was. In the Bell H-13.
Yep.
And for those listening, you may have told them this, Dale, but it was the aircraft that you see right in the first opening credits of MASH.
Right.
On those MASH episodes, little H-13, and I took instruments in that. What did you take it in?
It was in the H-13, and what they did with that, folks, I don't know why, well, I'm glad that they did teach us instruments, but they put a hood over your head, and you couldn't see out of the aircraft, and that was it.
Could not.
For, I don't know, 4 weeks, I think it was 8 weeks.
It was 2 months, and when you weren't flying in the air, they put you in a trainer, a link trainer, where they close you up and in a box, and you literally fly on hydraulics, and it simulates being on instruments also.
Right. It's like being in a shoebox.
It was.
Yeah.
Tough at first, too. I don't know about you, but it was not easy to get to do that.
No, I flew off the edge of the earth. So, because they had a pencil or the tracing line that, you'd have to fly these figure eights is what we did a lot of.
That's it.
And they showed me my piece of paper, and the paper pencil strip went right off the paper. And you're never going to make it. Of course, he said that every other day. But it's okay. Hey, listen, folks, if you want to get in on the conversation, if you were a helicopter pilot, door gunner, crew chief, had a great ride in a Huey or a more scary ride in a Huey, give us a call here at Veterans Radio. Our number locally is 734-822-1600. 734-822-1600. We've got about 2 minutes, Bob, before we're going to take a break at the bottom. See how fast it goes? I better let you do some more talking. So we got to Fort Rucker, and we transitioned into the Huey. Describe
yes.
the Huey to our audience.
When I got in that Huey, I had no idea an aircraft could be so smooth and so strong. And when I was writing that book, I was asked, well, what was it like? What was it like? And I instantly came up with what I could best describe it as like strapping a Corvette to your back. I loved that thing. I instantly loved it. I couldn't believe I had to. You could just pull it up, and the governor would take care of the throttle, number one. You didn't have to coordinate the throttle with the pitch when you increase the pitch of the blade. And I just couldn't wait to fly the thing in battle. I really couldn't. I thought, wow, this is unbelievable. We can go fast. You can do anything you want with it. And I just knew I was, you know how we are. You're God's gift to Army aviation.
It was pretty. I described that. I said it's like you were on a flying carpet. And you,
okay, there's another. That's a great one. That's right.
And you could go wherever you wanted to. You could go high. You could go low. And we'll talk low after the break.
Yeah.
And you can go fast forward. You could go backwards. You could go either direction, whatever you want. Anytime I talk to a jet jockey and they all talk about going 800 miles an hour, I say, how fast can you go backwards?
That's right. That's right.
And
800 miles an hour at 30,000 feet. Not the same as going 100 knots at 2.
That's very true. That's true. We're talking with Bob Ford. We're going to take a quick break for the news and a couple of announcements, and we'll be coming back. He's the author of Black Cat 2-1, all about helicopters. We're going to Vietnam in about 5 minutes, so don't go away. You're listening to Veterans Radio. We're back on Veterans Radio, listening to a little Give Me Shelter by the Rolling Stones. And the reason that I'm playing that is that somebody sent me a really cool YouTube video, and I don't normally open these things, but it's a story of the UH-1 Huey helicopter in Vietnam. And so I would encourage you to go to YouTube and check it out. It's a UH-1 Huey helicopter in Vietnam. It's a great trip down memory lane for pilots, but also give a lot of people out there a little bit more understanding of what we do. And, of course, the great music of the Rolling Stones. Those guys are even older than we are, Bob. And we're talking to Bob Ford, author of Black Cat 2-1. And if you've got a question or a comment and you want to get in on the conversation, you can give us a call here at 734-822-1600, or you can call us toll-free at 844-838-1600. So I encourage you to do that. If you want to watch that video, you can go to veteransradio.net, and I put a link right there so that you could watch it later on. Don't do it right now. So, Bob, you headed off to Vietnam. When did you arrive in Vietnam?
20 July of 67. And I was going to go to the cab, and they said they were full. And within a couple of days, I was flown over to Nha Trang for reassignment. And I looked at the board, and they said, any place you want to go? And I said, no, it doesn't matter. And I said, well, where are those guys? And I looked at the 282nd Assault, and they said, they're up the furthest northern helicopter unit in Vietnam, Army. And I said, well, I'll go there. And they said, well, why? I said, well, I just think things will go faster. I want to get with it.
Sounds good.
Yeah, it sounded good to me. And so when I got there, that's when I found out, you know, I just wasn't quite what I wanted. I wanted a little bit more, just a little bit more. And so I took over the detachment up at Way. Dale, I don't know if your listeners know, but the call sign is very simple. The Black Cat just comes from the 282nd Assault. Nickname Black Cats, and the two were the second flight platoon, and one was available when I became AC. That's that simple. I'm sure you must have been the second flight platoon yourself, and Zero was available when you made AC.
That's right. Exactly what happened. We were the Sky Chiefs. So, and that was just our company was the 195th Assault Helicopter Company. I want to remind our audience that Bob's unit, the 282nd, was up in I Corps. For those of you that are Vietnam historians and so forth, he's way up north. As far north as you can go is where he was. And so you ended up...
The detachment was obviously the furthest unit in Vietnam, for sure.
Absolutely.
And it was, of course, exciting every day. And I, Dale, I, I got the biggest honor from my men after I was there 3 days, flew with all of them, and had done quite a bit. And the senior pilot by experience, I should say, called me back in after I briefed him and said, Lieutenant Ford. He said, we all decided it's not going to be lieutenant and it's not going to be sir. From now on, it's going to be boss. And the pride I felt at that time was, I'm sure a lot of people have felt it through war, but I just really felt good, like I was, I'm here.
Well, it is. It's a great sensation when you finally arrive, and because you, it's just speaking for myself, you know, you're a lot nervous about what's going to happen and what might not happen and so on and so forth. And, you know, you're hoping all your skills and all the things that you learned. And, I mean, you're flying with some people whose skill and dexterity, I guess would be the term.
Right.
With a helicopter. I mean, they could put a helicopter in a room that wasn't, you know, that was too big for the helicopter, but they would fit it in.
That's right.
And so that was always something that was really exciting for me, is when they give you a name, and which was cool. You did have an initiation you had to go through for a little bit, didn't you?
Well, I did. They knew I was coming, and apparently they knew I was going to be a pretty square guy, because I could tell by the first time I met with them that there wasn't any pep talk or anything with these guys. You know, they'd already proven themselves, and the co-pilots had even been there quite a while too. Some of them had been there 5 months, and so they were all experienced bunch of guys, and they of course wondered about me. And I said I was going to, first thing to do was fly with all the aircraft commanders each day, and then all the co-pilots on the next 4 days. And after that, that's when they knew they had somebody that they could count on, apparently, because they told me that they'd call me boss from then on, and that's the way it was.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked after them, and we looked after each other. That's no question about it.
Well, that's pretty standard operating procedure, I think.
It is.
In the military.
It is.
Everybody looks out for everybody else, and especially when you're out there every day. So tell our audience, Bob, about what your missions were like. You're up there in I Corps. A lot of action going on a fairly regular basis. What kind of missions did you fly?
Well, the missions came about, usually you're flying by yourself, what we call single ship.
Mm-hmm.
And so the missions would come in at night. I'd get only an area and a frequency to contact a unit on the ground. But before we took off, I always made sure that we were had a pre-designated frequency that we could call the forward air controllers, the Army bird dog pilots, the guys who stayed up in the sky and coordinated stuff. We always knew how to get hold of them, and they knew how to get hold with us. It's very, very simple. All they would say was, any black cat in the vicinity of Quang Tri, come up uniform, and that was a pre-designated frequency on the UHF. And that's how we got most of our missions. It was ordered just by priority.
Mm-hmm.
And we had 3 aircraft and 8 pilots, and we covered 2,000 square miles, and as a result, we're always by ourselves. And so we would take off, and we'd make contact with a unit on the ground, and we'd tell them we're 1-0 out, 10 minutes out, what's your situation? And we knew that they were in contact over the night. We knew we'd been briefed, and if there were medevacs, we were told prior to taking off, so we knew what the situation was going to be, and all we wanted to know was approximate any condition as well as their location, and we'd go in hot and take care of them. And then from then, it would be flying the resupply, any more medevacs they needed, and then before anything else would happen, we might get another call, and we'd use our own judgment on prioritize where we'd go next. And as a result, we would fly easily 3 missions an hour sometimes.
Oh, I know.
It wasn't surprising at all.
It was just amazing how many different types of things that you could do in a day. You were assigned to MACV, which is a Military Assistance Command in Vietnam. Were you part of the 1st Aviation Brigade as well?
Yes. Yeah. Okay. That's the patch we had on our uniform was 1st Aviation. That's right. But we were attached to the MACV and under his control. It was a full colonel. Very tough guy, and I'd never even been around anything higher than a major, for crying out loud, up till then.
Oh, I know.
And so reporting it, you know, at attention with a full bird colonel, it was intimidating at first, but it was obvious he just loved us. He loved how we took care of things. He loved how we were an autonomous group that just would absolutely take care of anything would come up. And we found out years later that he even said he'd never seen a group perform so magnificently as that bunch of pilots up there. And it made me feel really good. And we never disappointed them. And any time we had to divert from a mission and to go prioritize go on another mission, he would get word of it. And I had to stand tall in front of him, and he had asked me questions about what we did and why we did it. And all I had to do was just tell him the truth. And he would usually stop me and say, okay, well, how about this other one? And I'd start that, and he'd say, okay, that's enough. How about another one? And then he'd say, okay, now, by the way, go write me a report. No copies. Make it in pencil. Put it underneath my door.
Mm-hmm.
And it'd take me about 30 minutes to write a report, and never was questioned. Never was.
I think most of them over there, you know, knew that we were, I don't know, our mission was to take, in my mind, was to take care of all the Americans on the ground, wherever they were.
Yeah.
And 9 out of 10 times, if there was a call, as you mentioned, come over guard or something and said, you know, need an aircraft in this area, that's where you went. If you were resupplying some guy at an outpost that was relatively safe, you might go low level and throw everything out and continue on to the other mission. But I think that that was really ingrained in us. I don't know where it was. I guess all the way back to flight school, where that was our mission. Our mission was to keep these guys alive as long as possible and to get them to safety whenever we could.
That's true. It just made you feel so good every time you accomplished a mission. It's an amazing feeling when those guys especially would say, you call that 0-2 out and say, this is like at 2-1, 0-2 out. What do you got? And a lot of times the guy on the ground would say, is this 2-1? I said, that's a firm. And they'd say, good. That made you feel good. Your reputation as the aircraft commander.
Yeah, sometimes your reputation does precede you, I guess would be the terminology. So we're talking with Bob Ford, author of Black Cat 2-1, and he's a helicopter pilot in Vietnam, and he flew supplies, you know, missions, medevac missions, everything. We flew slicks, which meant that we didn't have a whole lot of armament on us. We had 2 M60 machine guns, one on each side, and whatever personal weapons we carried. And that was it.
That's it.
And
that's true. One thing the guys on the ground really liked us a lot, Dale, because we would always, when things were over and we didn't have another mission, we'd say, do you guys need any suppressive fire?
Mm-hmm.
And they'd say, well, yeah.
Of
and
course.
So we would start. We'd find out where the enemy was. You know, they'd mark it with smoke, and we'd know where they were. And then we would start about 1,000 feet and work our way down to about 300, covering the area with fire. And they just loved us for doing that. And my door gunners, I was in a little bit unique in that I was assigned door gunners that were second tier infantrymen that actually looked forward to contact with the enemy. And most of the time they would suggest that. They'd get on the intercom and say, sir, do they need us to shoot the enemy for us? Well, let me ask. Let's see.
Can we shoot somebody? We're going to take a quick break, Bob.
Okay.
One last break, and then we'll come back, and I want to talk about the Tet Offensive a little bit here.
Oh, good. Yes, sir. That'd be good.
All right. We're talking to Bob Ford, author of Black Cat 2-1, the true story of a Vietnam helicopter pilot and his crew. We'll be right back after this. Just a little bit more Rolling Stones there, back here on Veterans Radio, talking with Bob Ford, author of Black Cat 2-1, true story of Vietnam helicopter pilot and his crew. Bob was stationed up north. He was stationed in Hue, and right around New Year's, 1968, you had a pleasant surprise, didn't you?
We did. 31 January of 68, the Tet Offensive started, and we knew things were different. The feel around all our landing zones was much more enemy fire. Everything felt that something was going to happen. I even wrote a letter home saying that. But on 31 January that night at 3 a.m., the rockets came in, and boy, did they come in. I don't know how close you've ever been to a rocket, but those that have, it's a deafening crack is the best way I can describe it.
Yes, it is. And you cannot dig a hole deep enough with your bare hands.
Yeah, you can. That's right. You can. And but everything scrambles in your brain. And but next thing I remember, I was in the bunker, and there was movement in front of us, and we were under ground attack. And as bad as we had it in front of us, which were hand grenades and small arms, the guys on the left and right of us were getting it a lot worse. And the one on the right where all my warrant officer pilots were, their hooch was over there about 20, 30 feet away from us, and their bunker was getting hit with RPGs. Jeez. And every one of them got either killed or wounded that night. Hmm. And it was it was unbelievable how things you just can't believe what you're doing. You're shooting, and then you think, what's going on? And then what did I fire this? Do I have any more ammo in my clip? Mm-hmm. What, you know, it's just a very confusing factor until one of my men, Tom Pullen, came to my bunker, and he had blood on him, and he said, "Boss, we're hit, and we're hit hard." And that's when I went to the other bunker and pulled out the last pilot, a guy named Gilmore, and took him to the medic, which is kind of the central part of the compound. But after that, the only reason that they didn't break through on the ground was an Australian and an old 30 caliber machine gun he had set up there, and it kept him from coming in. But it was very chaotic, and it was we got those guys out. My men were medevaced out, and for the next 3 days and nights, we stayed up and fought those little buggers until I got out.
So you were on the ground actually defending.
Yeah.
Your part of way there as it's being overrun.
As far as I know, we're the only pilots that had perimeter duty mm-hmm. during ground attacks.
How soon did you get back in the air?
Well, I got out of there on the 3rd, and I went up the morning of the 6th, and went up on a mission, and I didn't put it in the book, but honest to God, I was shaking so bad. I thought, God, you got to control yourself. You got to control yourself. You got a young pilot here to depend on you, much less the crew. And I went up there to medevac some Vietnamese, but a lot of Marines, and take them to Phu Bai. And I got it done. But I did that for 2 days, and then on the third day, I flew about at least 6-7 missions every day, and then I led a flight of 4 in there and nailed it perfectly. The weather was real bad, and I low-leveled up there. I could low-level through the area because we had practiced flying low-level. And I led those guys into a small medevac pad inside the Citadel, and we got all the ammo in, took the medevacs out. Everybody took fire. We went to the coast and then went back home. And I went back home at Da Nang more than maybe 20 minutes after shutdown. And they came in and said, "You got to go back," because I was the only one that knew it, how to get into the Citadel low level, because mm-hmm. all the pilots from the way detachment were gone. And that's when I really got scared. And I can remember trying to walk to the aircraft, and I looked down and I thought, "What in the world is that?" My M16 was shaking so bad I didn't know it was me. And I couldn't talk. I felt like I was going to fall off a cliff. And I finally figured something out. I said, I went back to the platoon hooch, and I knew if I took another experienced aircraft commander with me, mm-hmm. and I bet you've had this same feeling, Dale. If you could take another AC with you, you knew you had somebody that would get you back if you got shot, much less take over if anything happened.
Absolutely.
That's what I did.
Yeah. Good thinking.
I walked in, and I... By the time I got there, I knew who I wanted. It was a guy by the name of Bart Colburn. And I hadn't flown with him for 5 months, but we made aircraft commander together 5 months prior. And I always liked the guy, and I'd flown with him a little bit before going away. And so I said, "I want another AC to go with me, Colburn."
Mm-hmm.
And he jumped up, got his .45 pistol, and was walking next to me. And I thought, my gosh, maybe I'm going to make this. Mm-hmm. And we flew probably 60 missions into the battle. All of it low level, every bit of it under heavy fire, single ship, mm-hmm. up until R&R, which was 19 February.
Wow.
Every day.
Ooh. I'm sorry. I got goosebumps here, folks, and it's only because I'm doing a little time tripping while he's talking about these things and thinking. Just, I don't know if we can describe to people. I'll let you go first. How do you describe low-level flying, and how low did you like to go?
Well, the reason we went low-level is because the enemy has a lot less chance of getting you, because you only have about 7 seconds that you can get on an aircraft going that fast until you're out of maximum effective range. And so low-level was something we did all the time, even when it's bad weather, but this was necessary because the weather was at best a half mile, and most of the time was only of a quarter of a mile visibility. So things go zipping by pretty fast when you're going 100 knots. And low would be probably no less than 2, but no more than 10 feet high at the most.
This is so cool.
My door gunners were most of them were pretty experienced. And what they do when we low-leveled, they kept the machine guns down and back. At all times. And so when we took fire, you see it, and when it's close, you can hear it.
Right.
And so when you start hearing it, even though they're in a concealed position, they start firing, and the momentum of the aircraft will take it right to them. I asked my men one time, I said, how many rounds does it take to get on those guys? I said, you guys get them all the time. Mm-hmm. And they said, 3. I said, 3? He said, yeah.
These guys, it's amazing.
They want to keep coming to a machine gun fight with rifles. We'll kill them every time, sir.
That's true. The thing for our audience out there to remember, and they are aware of it, when you hear a helicopter company, especially a Huey, you don't know what direction it's coming from.
You don't.
First of all, and it, even with the practiced ear that sometimes I think we have, it takes us a while to figure it out too. And by the time you do, if he's flying at 5 to 10 feet off the ground, they're gone by the time you see them. And,
sure are.
And that's the point. That was probably the most exciting thing. And it's for motorcycle riders out there. It's close, but I'm sorry. I don't mean to be giggling. It was such an adrenaline rush.
It was
to do that, but it also got us in and out of a lot of places a lot quicker, and in most cases a lot safer.
It did. And
literally limited exposure.
Limited exposure, and you're being an aircraft commander. You knew where you were. Pretty well where you were all the time, and you slowed that thing up so you didn't bust over the landing zone and have to make a go around. You always had things timed just right to zero your airspeed and touchdown almost at the same time.
It's great memories, Bob, like that, and things about the skills that we had when we look back almost 50 years and think, I did that. That was pretty cool. So
it was.
Where did you do your R&R?
I met my wife for our first wedding anniversary in Hawaii.
Oh, I did the same thing. Not the same
thing. Yeah. Was it your first wedding anniversary?
First wedding anniversary, yep.
Yeah. I've been gone 7 months. Had you been gone 7 months?
Because I went to wedding in July. July 1969 is when I went.
Well, I was only just a day out of flying combat into the Tet Offensive, and the day before I went, or that morning, I had to go ID one of my men over at Morgan, Da Nang. Oh, I got on the aircraft. I think we went down to Cameron, and from Cameron we flew directly to Hawaii. I think that's how it went. But I tell you, I could hardly get away from the war at the time. When I got off at the bus at Fort DeRussy, this real pretty girl came up and said, "Hello, Bob, it's me." I didn't know who she was. I really didn't. But I got acquainted pretty quick after that.
I would think so. That was a really difficult thing to do, and we don't
it
have
was,
time to discuss the whole thing. But I can remember, sending you back to civilization, to your loved ones, to American food, cars, everything else for a week, and then they bring you back. That's kind of cruel and unusual punishment, I think.
It was looking back, it's very humorous, actually. Even at the time, it was humorous. When I called my mom and dad on the pre-designated time, and I said, first thing Dad said was, "Hey, old buddy, I think you had it kind of rough in your area." I said, "Yes, sir, but I'm all right." Well, he said, "Well, let me tell you something. I'm going to go to Africa and go hunting." And so we talked about that the entire time.
Well, you know, talking to our parents or sending letters, which you do, and in the book, folks, again, you got to read this book. It's Bob Ford, Black Cat 2-1. We've only got about a minute and a half, Bob, and there's so many more things I would love to talk with you about, and maybe we can do this again. I think it's kind of fun for both of us to go through that. So where can we get the book?
Well, I can get it on the website, directly from the website, and it's www.blackcat2-1.com.
Okay.
And either that or Amazon, and you'll get it pronto.
Okay.
Amazon has it, and they'll get it to you pronto.
And we didn't talk about everything in the book, because you went back and was an instructor pilot back at Fort Walters.
I was.
And I went back to Fort Rucker and got to teach the level flying, which was really fun. I want to encourage our audience to go out, you know, buy this book. There are so many adventures and things in there. How many hours did you end up with combat hours?
I had 960 recorded. We lost some of the hours, some of the log books in the ground attack. It got destroyed, but 960 recorded hours.
You know, and well over 1,000 different missions.
Yeah.
And we counted missions differently, I think, than the Air Force and all those other guys did. You know, how many landings did we make a day? How many takeoffs did we make a day? And so on and so forth.
It could be 40 easy an hour.
Oh,
easy.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, we've run out of time again. I want to thank Bob Ford for being on Veterans Radio. Black Cat 2-1 is the book. Make sure you go out and read it. I think you'll have an adventure when you get that. Thanks very much, Bob.
Dale, it's my honor, my pleasure. Thank you so much, sir.
Okay. We'll be back next week. We're going back to Vietnam. Music of Vietnam, Part 2. Until then, you are dismissed.